Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me very great pleasure to welcome you to this, the first inaugural lecture of this academic year. Inaugural lectures are, I think, a wonderful academic institution, and they certainly do wonders for the education of the director. I have sort of instant education on the most bewildering number of subjects and disciplines since at least I've been director. All our new professors have been asked to give inaugural lectures. Hasn't been entirely true. I discovered to my surprise that Karl Popper managed to get by without ever having given an inaugural, but he was made a professor before I was director. So it's very great pleasure to welcome you to this, the first of our new season. And particularly, if I may say, to a lecture given by Dominic Levin. Dominic is has had a most unusual and distinguished academic career. He started it by being born in Singapore, which was somewhat unusual. And as I'm sure you know, he comes from a very distinguished background, being related to the Imperial Russian family. Which makes his birthplace even more surprising. However, he was educated in Downside School, Somerset, went to Cambridge, Christ's College, where he got a BA in history, a double first with distinction, and then went to Harvard, all very normal for an academic career. He then went to the FCO in London, for where he was responsible for relations with Afghanistan and Nepal, continuing a family tradition. He then, however, discovered that he was really an academic rather than a civil servant, and did a PhD at the School of Slavonic Studies under the supervision of Professor Hugh Seton Watson, and he's been an academic ever since. He was appointed lecturer in Russian government at the LSE in 1978, and with time off to visit the Soviet Union and Germany and other such places, he's been with us ever since. He's published very widely in recent Russian and East European history, publishing books, for example, on topics such as Russia and the origins of the First World War, Russia's rulers under the old regime, the Soviet crisis, the aristocracy in Europe, the sort of family history, Nicholas II, Emperor of all Russia. And so it is with very great anticipatory pleasure I invite him to give us his inaugural lecture, which I hope will summarize all of that, Russia in the Imperial Mirror. Chai.
I've been promoted to be a Romanov. It's a good start to the lecture. In recent decades, at least, empire has not been a very fashionable topic for social scientists. In comparison, reams of books have been written about imperialism. And by imperialism, I mean the process by which the Western maritime empires were created, the imperial polities, they created the economic bases of those polities, and indeed of the world order, which emerged from the expansion of Europe into the wider world. There are rather obvious political reasons why imperialism, rather than empire, should have attracted the attention of social scientists. The question of imperialism went to the root of the ideological conflict between the Soviet Union and the West. It also went to the root of the growing dispute between the First and Third Worlds about the causes of inequality and poverty in the contemporary world. In comparison to that, empire seemed really a matter of the past. A question which might be of interest to historians, but certainly not to those who were interested, above all, in the contemporary world. And if social scientists in general fled from the study of empire, Sovietologists did so with even more fervour than most, for three reasons. The first is that if you began defining the Soviet Union as an empire, you defined yourself simultaneously as the blackest of cold warriors. The second reason was simply that empire appeared to be a thing of the past, and the Soviet Union was rather obviously a thing of the present, at least in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. And Sovietology, like political science in general, did pride itself very much on being a study of the politics of the present. And that was a third reason why Sovietologists did not attempt to study Russia in the context of comparative works on empire, because to do so would be to divorce oneself from the mainstream of political science. Now, it is, of course, the premise of this lecture that it is of interest both to students of Russia and to students of empire to look at Russia and the Soviet Union in what I describe as the imperial mirror. It's another premise of this lecture that actually the study of empire is of interest and concern to people who aren't particularly interested in Russia, because there are many issues in the contemporary world which are illuminated by this comparative study of empires. Having said that, it is quite understandable that social scientists did tend to fight shy of using the concept of empire. It is a slippery and difficult concept. In part, that's the case simply because of its political connotations. Take the example, for instance, of definitions of empire in the context of France's war in Algeria in the 1950s. It made an enormous difference whether one defined Algeria as Algérie française, part of the metropolis, as much a part of France as Brittany or Corsica, or the other areas which, as we are reminded, were turned from being provincial peasant societies into French, part of French society in the 19th century. If Algérie was indeed française, then what one was facing with the possibility of Algerian independence was the destruction, the dismemberment of the sacred soil of the motherland. If, on the other hand, you defined Algeria as basically a colony, if you defined the struggle with Paris as a colonial struggle for independence, then you were not talking about secession or the violation of the sacred soil of France, but on the contrary, you were talking about part of a process of decolonization which seemed to be necessary, natural, an inherent element in modernity. It isn't, though, just that defining empires is politically risky. It's also that the concept itself is just a rather difficult one. Now, in my view, an empire has to be a great power. That is a sine qua non of empire. To be worthy of the name, an empire has to play a very significant role in defining the international relations of a historical epoch. And not just the international relations, but also the culture and the values of that epoch. If you aren't a great power, then you are not subjected to many of the temptations which are part and parcel of being an empire, temptations towards militarism, towards expansionism. You are also not involved in the self-perception of the kind of self-perceptions, visions of their own role in history, which tend to come to the ruling elites of great powers. Empire as well carries its own cultural burden, even in terms of architecture, forms of art. So if you're not a great power, you're not an empire. But that doesn't necessarily mean that if you are a great power, you are an empire. Because after all, nation states can be great powers, and even in some periods, so can city states. To be an empire implies that you control wide territories, with all that that means in terms of problems of controlling, mobilizing population and resources over these enormous areas. And being an empire implies that you rule a multi-ethnic polity, because managing multi-ethnicity has always been one of the great difficulties of empire, and became probably the greatest of all the difficulties of running an empire in the modern age of nationalism. If you're going to talk about great power as empire, I think also you're talking about a form of control which is direct, which is administrative, which is not simply a method of indirect influence. What you've perhaps noted for its absence in my definition of empire is something which the student of imperialism and of the Western maritime empires would immediately put their finger on, and that is the distinction between the metropolis and the periphery, between the ruling nation and the subject nations. Now, the absence of that element in my definition is not accidental, because in many of the empires that I have studied, aristocratic, absolutist empires, the ruling elites, the aristocracies, did not truly associate with any community of subjects. Russia itself provides a good example of that. In 18th century Russia, a Russian peasant could be the serf of a Baltic German landowner, Protestant landowner anywhere in the country, a Tatar landowner. But no Muslim Tatar could be the serf of a Russian nobleman. The Russian peasant enjoyed less rights, paid higher taxes, was subjected to fiercer forms of conscription than his Tatar equivalent. Very difficult at that point to call the Russian people the ruling people of an empire. Despite the fact that the Russian Empire in the 18th century is a polity defined by the terms precisely, Russian and empire, therefore, I think you would be very sadly mistaken in this case, as indeed in many others, the Ottoman, for example, to talk of metropolis and periphery. Now, I'm aware of the fact that even in terms of the criteria that I have been discussing, my definitions of empire are rather imprecise and distinctly impressionistic. To be honest, that doesn't worry me. I am not trying to create some form of ideal type of empire against which specific empires can be measured. All I am trying to do is to make comparisons between Russia and the Soviet Union on the one hand, and a number of polities whose status as empire has never been denied by anyone. First and foremost, what I have concentrated on are great empires of antiquity, first and foremost the Chinese and the Romans, the greatest of the maritime empires, the English and the Spanish, and Russia's two great land neighbours and rivals, the Ottoman Empire and the Habsburgs. Now, in one sense, I'm aware of the fact that foregoing the opportunity to define ideal types and instead trying to actually go for comparisons between empires actually makes matters more complicated than ever. The point is that empires are not uniform either across all their dominions or over time. It never occurred to the Romans to rule the Greek civilized East and the barbarian West of their empire in similar manner. Still less did it ever occur to the English to govern non-white natives and white settler colonies in the same way. If you were going to generalize about the British Empire, I suppose the usual stereotype would be that this was a relatively liberal, relatively decentralized, relatively unideological empire. And perhaps if you compare the British Empire overall with others, that generalization would be true. But as Christopher Bailey reminds us, it would be a lot truer of some eras than others. In response to the loss of the British-American Empire in the 1770s, the British imperial state became very significantly more authoritarian, more ideological, more militarist, more paternalist, a process which was still further hardened by 20 years of struggle against revolutionary and Napoleonic France. The British Empire of the 1820s was still a very long way from the mid-Victorian liberal model. And if that's true in the British case, it's abundantly true in Russia as well. The Russian stereotype, I suppose, as regards empire, would be autocratic, centralized. Fair enough, over the centuries as a generalization. But in the 18th century, and indeed much of the 19th century, Russia's western provinces, meaning above all the Baltic provinces, Finland, Poland briefly, were actually governed by local elites in elected, in inverted commas, feudal institutions, which had nothing whatsoever in common with the Russian autocratic tradition, and everything in common with the central and western feudal traditions from which, after all, those institutions sprang. If you look at the Soviet Union, you can make similar distinctions, both over time and across the Union. You don't probably need me to tell you that the Soviet Union and the Soviet nationalities problem was very differently directed in the 1920s under NEP than it was in the 1930s and the 1940s under high Stalinism. In fact, by imperial standards, the Soviet Union was run in a relatively uniform manner. The same constitutional and institutional arrangements applied throughout all republics, even to a great extent in Russia itself. And yet, even in the Soviet Union, the reality of politics was never the same from republic to republic. Take, for instance, the example of Ukraine. On the one hand, Ukrainians enjoyed far greater possibilities of rising in the central political and security branches of the All-Union party and government. On the other hand, Ukraine was subjected to a far more ruthless and thorough program of Russianization under Brezhnev than was true of any other republic, with the exception of Belarus. Well, in a way, that might make you despair. Here we are trying to compare empires. We can't even pin down an individual empire because it shifts across its provinces and it shifts across time. I think the answer is don't despair. Comparing empires is never going to be an exact science. The reason for making the comparison is that it might just be useful, and that is indeed why I make that comparison. If you think of it, 2,000 years ago, at either end of Eurasia, vast areas were controlled by two great empires, at one end the Roman, at the other the Han Chinese. Both of those empires were destroyed by nomadic, in inverted commas, barbarians from Inner Asia. On the whole, though, over the last 2,000 years, whereas the imperial tradition and imperial unity reasserted itself in East Asia, i.e. in the Chinese Empire, the opposite occurred at this end of the Eurasian geopolitical space. In some senses, the contemporary problems of the European Union on the one hand and of China on the other are to a great extent determined by the fact that empire did prevail at one end of Eurasia and didn't at the other. In one sense, what we are attempting to do, or some of us are attempting to do, in Western Europe is precisely to create some kind of substitute to fill the gap which the Roman Empire left, though without the bureaucratic, authoritarian, anti-democratic elements, which are an inherent part of empire. You don't need me to tell you that it is not exactly easy to create this continent-wide market and the political institutions and values to sustain it against the opposition of centuries of deeply embedded national consciousness, and in the face of the fact that aspects of empire don't sit very easily, or aspects of continent-wide bureaucratic organisation, to put things politely, don't sit very easily either with entrepreneurial dynamism or with individual freedom. At the other end of Eurasia, in China, really the problem is the exact opposite. There you do indeed have a polity of continental scale and of more than continental population. Not only Western onlookers, but many Chinese too, put down China's backwardness in part to the costs of trying to sustain that imperial polity and the great tradition on which it was based. Interestingly, one of the people who made the case for this point of view was Mao Zedong himself. This is a quote from him. He said, "One good thing about Europe is that all its countries are independent. Each of them does its own thing, which makes it possible for the economy of Europe to develop at a fast pace. Ever since China became an empire after the Qin dynasty, our country has been for the most part unified. One of its defects has been bureaucratism and extremely tight control. The localities could not develop independently." What is going on, in a sense, right now in China is an attempt to preserve the imperial polity and yet at the same time to loosen controls in a way which will allow individual dynamism to bring China out of backwardness. It's not easily managed, and the rulers of China are aware that the process could get out of control. China, in a sense, at least in the view of this ignorant onlooker, is an empire halfway on the path to being a nation. It's almost as if the Roman Empire had survived in Western Europe, and its high culture, its imperial language, had seeped down over the centuries into the tribal roots of the population. Among the traditional factors making for unity in China, the power of the state, on the whole, the intellectual hegemony possessed by the bureaucrats and scholars whom the state has sustained, a uniform written language, impressive high culture, and the superior technology of the Han people, the Han Chinese, to the various tribal peoples they assimilated. Perhaps also the nature of the Chinese imperial ideology is important. A Confucian society lacks something of the doctrinal dogmatism, which you obviously get in Marxism-Leninism, and which in a sense is part of an ultimately Judaic tradition which incorporated both Christianity and Islam. You're less likely to get terrible disputes over issues such as the filioque clause in this kind of society. The stress in China has traditionally been less on what you think, or at least less on doctrine than on ritual. And the Chinese imperial state put a very great stress on creating all imperial rituals, not merely at the highest level of politics, but even in terms of trying to ensure that ordinary Chinese followed roughly similar rituals when they got married, or above all, when they died and were buried. Possibly that is a strength. Certainly the way in which the imperial state combined flexibility, allowing various kinds of cultural rituals of the provinces to merge into a broader imperial ritual, is very interesting for anyone who, like myself, in a very amateur way, tried to study the efforts of the Soviet state to create new rituals which would, to some extent, create or underpin the creation of a new Soviet man out of the varied ethnic material that made up the USSR. Add to the traditional factors making for Chinese unity the deliberate attempt in the 20th century to create a common language from above, Putonghua. Add to that a well-justified Chinese resentment against Western and Japanese treatment of China, and you certainly have powerful support for the maintenance of an imperial polity. Nevertheless, if you apply to China the normal definitions of Western political science, you would be hard-pressed to say that this is already a nation. Vast regions containing very much of China's natural resources are, after all, inhabited by non-Han minorities. Even the Han population is divided among a whole range of groups speaking mutually incomprehensible languages, which are certainly more diverse than the whole range of Romance languages in Europe. It is to the point that the most economically dynamic areas in China, which tend to be the coastal and particularly southern coastal areas, are inhabited by people who, in ultimate ethnic origin, particularly in Guangdong, are closer to Vietnamese than to the peoples of the north, of the northern heartlands. And when you add to that the way in which economic development, very uneven economic development in those coastal and southern areas, is creating societies which are very different to those of the northern heartland, with interests that are very different, you have to wonder about some of the strains which are being put on this traditional polity. Remember, too, that the investment coming into China from the overseas Chinese is going into these coastal areas and is being made by people who, in their language and in their, you know, ultimate origins, in the overwhelming majority of cases, come from those areas. That can only increase the sense of difference of these southern areas, as can the reincorporation of Hong Kong into China. Now, it isn't for someone as ignorant as myself to make predictions about what happens in China, but it would certainly be worthwhile for those holding power in Beijing to reflect on one pattern of imperial decline, which one can see prevailing, at least in certain epochs of history. Centralized bureaucratic imperial polities straining to control far-flung provinces often find it very difficult indeed to adapt to rapid economic development in the periphery, but not at the center. That was certainly true of the Ottoman, Mughal, Persian empires in the 18th century, contributed to the collapse of the latter two and the great weakening of the Ottomans. Even to some extent, if you look at Britain and Spain's loss of their American colonies in the 18th century, you can see aspects of this. What happens is a centre which first loses control over elites and taxes in the periphery and then sparks off revolt when it tries to regain it. In the Spanish case, the government in Madrid certainly forfeited its legitimacy among the Creole elites by attempting to reassert, and indeed successfully reasserting, central control in the second half of the 18th century. True enough, the empire finally imploded when the metropolis itself was taken over by Napoleon. Nevertheless, the foundations for the collapse of that empire did lie in a process, this pattern of losing control and then trying to reassert it. You could even spot a similar pattern to some extent in Central Asia in the last decade of the Soviet Union. The effect of corruption under Brezhnev was de facto to create a very considerable degree of autonomy in Soviet Central Asia. One of the great aims of Gorbachev's crackdown on corruption was to reassert the center's control, its ability to execute its policies, and not to be cheated in those Central Asian republics. That attempt to reassert control went a very long way to wrecking the legitimacy of the center in Central Asia. Though, as in the Spanish case, it was not those policies which led to the collapse of the Soviet Empire in Central Asia, but rather the implosion of the center itself in 1991. There is enough going on in contemporary China to at least spot some parallels of that sort. Now, if it's the case that conceivably, just conceivably, China in the near future could provide rather interesting examples of the decline of empire, it's of course true that in the last decade, the Soviet Union has already done so. Contrary to the view of many Russians that their post-imperial dilemmas and crises are unique, dilemmas in particular about a post-imperial identity and post-imperial frontiers, it seems to me actually that those problems are by no means unique or unprecedented. What is unique is, if you like, the post-imperial geopolitical reality, to put things in horrible terms, in the former Soviet Union. The point is that when the Austrians or the Turks or the English or the French lost their empires, they were automatically relegated to semi-irrelevance on the world scene. The metropolis simply did not control sufficient resources to enable it to play a very significant role in international affairs. The great point about Russia is that because Russian colonization was in contiguous areas, the Russian state to this day has hung on to what you could describe as the crown jewels of empire, namely Siberia. Russia can shed an empire and not just remain a great power, but if it mobilizes its resources more intelligently in a post-imperial era, it can actually re-emerge on the world scene even more powerful than before. One aspect of the fact that Russian colonization was in contiguous areas are those 25 million Russians who live just on the other side of Russia's borders with the other former republics of the USSR. Those 25 million people are not, in a sense, lost to Russian power. As Spanish colonists in Latin America, for instance, were lost to Spain's power after independence. They are actually a very significant factor in Russia's ability to reassert its domination throughout the former USSR. And the fact that even having shed an empire, Russia is a great power means that in sharp distinction, for instance, to the Turks in 1918 to 22, or indeed to the British in the Middle East or South Asia after the Second World War, other rival powers are very unlikely to stick their noses into Russia's geopolitical space. Therefore, the point is not that Russia's post-imperial trauma is necessarily any more traumatic than other people's. I don't think it is. It is merely a great deal more important and a great deal more worrying. Some precedents are certainly worth citing. The Austrian one, for instance. The Austrian Republic lacked really any kind of historical legitimacy when created in 1918. Before 1918, Austrian Germans had associated either with the monarchy as a whole or with their specific Land. The Austrian Republic was neither the monarchy as a whole, nor was it a Land. In any case, very many Austrian Germans lived outside the borders of the Republic of Austria, most notably in the Czech Sudetenland. Beyond that, the Austrian Republic was a pathetic shadow of the old monarchy, both in terms of its grandeur and in terms of the opportunities it offered to Austrians. There was a tremendous problem as well, because what had been a very large free trade area suddenly turned into a tiny little Austrian Republic. And that problem was exacerbated by the collapse of the world economy after 1929. The Austrian Republic, in the interwar period, never enjoyed the possibility of legitimizing itself through economic success. And it is not particularly surprising that many Austrians, when the opportunity offered itself, thought that Anschluss was a very attractive alternative. In some ways, comparisons with the Turks are even more interesting. One reason why Russians, in general, instinctively reject the idea that Russia or the Soviet Union was an empire is that, partly due to an overdose of Marxism-Leninism, the conviction is deeply embedded in most Russians that empires make the metropolis rich, that empires make the ruling people rich. You know, English people are rich because they ran around trading slaves and bashing Africans on the head. Now, it seems to me that in claiming that empire never made the ordinary Russian rich, one is more or less asserting a truism. In arguing that this necessarily makes Russia different to other great imperial polities, one is actually talking nonsense. Some great empires do make the metropolitan population, if not rich, at least provide it with many benefits. In Rome, for instance,
The Roman population paid no taxes and was very heavily subsidized by free food coming in from the empire. Even in the English case, though, there is legitimate room for debate as to just how much the English population benefited from formal empire, as distinct from, you know, the informal domination of the world, which was part and parcel of Britain's economic and naval preeminence. When you get on to some other empires, it is absolutely clear that the great majority of the metropolitan population, in no sense whatsoever, benefited from empire. This, I think, is true of the population of Castile in the 16th and 17th centuries, but it is unequivocally true of the population of Anatolia, which in a sense you could describe a little bit, actually, anachronistically as the heartland of the Ottoman Empire, at least the homeland of most of the Turks. Anatolia was one of the most backward and one of the least privileged provinces in the Ottoman Empire, even in 1900. Moreover, if it is the case that to some extent Russian aristocratic elites under the empire, and even more so elements of the Soviet elite after 1917, had a distinctly equivocal attitude to aspects of Russian tradition, Russian cultural values, the same was true on a far grander scale of the Ottoman elite. Ottoman high culture regarded the word Turk as a term of abuse. It meant provincial nobody. Far from associating themselves in any way whatsoever with the culture or the traditions of the Turkish folk, the Ottoman elite and the Ottoman state did everything it could, or they could, to distance themselves from Turkishness. If you look at Turkey's post-imperial crisis, you also see some pretty unpleasant potential parallels. Once you emerged from the multi-ethnic Ottoman Empire and tried to recreate political order in the Turkish rump state on the national principle, you had a horrible time coping with those people who had the misfortune to live within the borders of this new Turkish rump state, but didn't call them or didn't feel themselves to be Turks. The Kurdish question, still at the forefront of the world's attention, is a precise result of the supersession of a relatively tolerant multi-ethnic empire by a nation state. And in a way, too, so is the dilemma of Turkish elites as to whether Turkey belongs to Europe or not. Once you have lost your imperial identity, where do you go next? Turkey's elites, true to the tradition of Atatürk, may believe they belong in Europe. Most Europeans probably wouldn't agree, and so probably would the majority of ordinary Turks, for whom a Muslim identity is stronger than any sense of common European culture. At first sight, it might seem rather strange to include among the post-imperial polities polities which are undergoing post-imperial traumas, not just the Austrians and the Turks, but also the English. In one sense, the process of escaping from empire, decolonization, has, after all, been extraordinarily smooth in the English or British case. Some aspects of the contemporary Russian crisis of identity certainly don't exist in the United Kingdom. Unlike the Austrians, the Turks, or the Russians, for instance, the English did create a nation-state long before they created an empire. The Tudor monarchy was a nation-state. It's also true that the borders between the English nation-state and the overseas empire were very sharply defined, to some extent in law, but even more obviously in geography. Simply by going overseas, the ordinary English colonist had a far clearer conception of the distinction between motherland and colony than the wretched Russian simply moving another 100 miles across the steppe. A consciousness of empire, a consciousness of the distinction between homeland and empire, simply doesn't exist in the Russian case in the way that it does among the peoples of the maritime empires. It's also true that colonial identities, colonial patriotism, revolved around, to some extent anyway, the existence of self-governing institutions in the provinces. Not merely, I mean, this is true actually even with the Spanish, with their audiencias. It was even more true of the representative institutions which the English created. Very interesting that the Russian Empire went out of its way never to allow such institutions to exist either in Siberia or in New Russia, which you and I now know as southern Ukraine. And it's also true that in the British case, not merely was eventual preparation for self-government always an important aspect of empire's legitimacy in the eyes of part of British public opinion, but also the British process of decolonization was, in a sense, an extension to the international sphere of aristocracy's slow, gradual, peaceful surrender of power in the 19th century to a broader and broader electorate. And precisely because that was the case, the British could to some extent escape from empire, not only relatively peacefully and rather gradually, but even with their pride more or less intact. Since none of this appears to be the case with the Russians, why is it sensible, therefore, to make these comparisons about post-imperial crises? I think the key is to take yourself back beyond the mid-19th century to a world in which empire, in the British context, meant not just overseas colonies, but also Ireland and indeed the United Kingdom, meaning Scotland itself. Certainly Ireland is an extremely interesting topic for anyone who is trying to make comparisons between empire in Britain and in Russia. It seems to me that one of the things that 19th and early 20th century Irish history illustrates is the problems for any imperial power which is liberal and increasingly democratic when it attempts to incorporate what is essentially a colony into the metropolis. It is not just that Irish MPs came to exercise a quite unwanted degree of power at Westminster. It's also that inevitably it was very difficult to deny to part of the metropolis the liberal and then democratic rights which that metropolis itself was developing. Once you applied democracy in Ireland, you were bound to undermine those groups in Irish society who were the firm bulwark of union. Now, once Home Rule came onto the agenda, you could well argue that from Westminster's point of view, it was vital to keep Ulster in an Ireland enjoying Home Rule, really as a Trojan horse to ensure that no government in Dublin ever tried to move Home Rule in the direction of independence. The British government's failure to do that was in part perhaps the result of Irish policy being the plaything of party politics in Westminster. But it was also very definitely part of the fact that Westminster couldn't control this element of the overseas settler population, i.e. the Ulster Unionists. In the Russian case, it certainly will be interesting to see to what extent Russian policy towards the Russian diaspora in the near abroad is determined by Russian factional politics, the extent to which Moscow can control the political ambitions of the diaspora and its leaders, the extent to which we will see parallels with the history of the Irish Free State's relations with London. The Irish Free State was totally dependent economically on the United Kingdom in many ways. For decades after its formal autonomy, it nevertheless, in political terms, was a thorn in the British flesh. You only have to think of the denial of bases to the Royal Navy in the Second World War. We'll see whether some of the parallels, none of them particularly pleasant, which Anglo-Irish relations suggest, do emerge on the Russian scene. It is, for instance, true now that Dublin has found an alternative source of patronage, an alternative power centre in Brussels. It is not entirely beyond imagination that in some future world order, Brussels, Bonn, Berlin, you name it, might emerge as an alternative power centre, an alternative sense source of patronage and support for some of the former Soviet republics. There again, once you're dealing with
you know, this question of comparing Britain and the former Soviet Union, you can make some relatively sensible comparisons between Scotland and Ukraine. Scotland and Ukraine were brought into their respective imperial polities at the beginning of the 17th century, and their position was consolidated in the first decade of the 18th century, the Battle of Poltava, in the Ukrainian case, the Act of Union, in the Scottish one. I think the cultural distance between London and Edinburgh was not entirely dissimilar to that between Moscow and Kiev. If you look at 18th century Scotland and Ukraine, it's clear that in both cases, the native elites benefit enormously from empire. It's also interesting that Scotland and Ukraine diverge in the 1830s and 40s. It's in those decades that you see the origins of anti-Russian radical Ukrainian nationalism. It's precisely at that time that the Scots seem to be happiest with their position in the British Empire. One reason for that is that under the Union, the Scots maintain their own law, their own church, and their own system of local government. Another is that it was much easier to take pride in being part of what was, after all, the richest, most powerful, and in many ways most progressive polity on earth at that time, namely Britain and its empire. One reason why Ukrainian radical nationalism emerges, firstly, is that the Russian centralizing bureaucracy has wiped the slate clean in Ukraine, destroying all the political institutions of the Hetmanate. Another is that it is simply a reaction against bureaucratic despotism. If you live under Nicholas I's regime, it makes rather good sense to try and recreate the freedom-loving Ukrainian Cossack as the symbol of Ukrainian identity. When you come on to the sort of post-imperial era in Britain, though, some of the similarities with Ukraine perhaps do begin to come out. After all, the Anglo-Scottish Union was based on Protestantism. That Protestantism and liberty were indissolubly linked. It was based on opposition to France, despotic, the old enemy, a country which the British fought and usually defeated for 120 years. As always, identities are created against as much as for. And it was cemented both by the victory of Britain in those wars and the material and psychological benefits that brought. Take away all of that, and all of that has been taken away since 1945. And the argument might well be that not merely the advantages, but the symbols of empire, the imperial monarchy itself, begin to be undermined. Perhaps it's not entirely a coincidence that all the peripheral empires in Europe, the Russian, the Ottoman, the British, all of them in their post-imperial era face terrible problems of trying to define what their relationship should be to the European core. Now, if you're going to make general comparisons between the Russian and other empires, particularly the maritime ones, you have to inevitably stress both some key obvious similarities and other very major differences. The major difference, as is often the case, is terribly simple. Russia was, after all, one contiguous land mass. One result of that is that the Russians and most of the other peoples who later formed part of the Soviet Union had had what you could describe politely as an ongoing relationship for more than two millennia, right back into the Kievan era. You've got, for instance, members of the Russian aristocracy marrying into the aristocracy of the nomadic tribes. And that is a tradition which comes right down through the Russian Empire. You know, who was the man who threw Rasputin into the canal? Yusupov, but of course the descendant of a Tatar. The intermarriage of the Russian imperial elite with a range of people, some of whom are Tatar, Asiatic, you name it, marks the Russian imperial polity off very clearly from its, you know, maritime European rivals or whatever. And that is a Russian imperial tradition which does come down into the Soviet elite as well. Another and perhaps most significant point is simply that the area which encompassed the Russian Empire and Soviet Union was one ecological unit. The biggest single element in the suffering of the colonized people at the expense of the maritime powers is caused by ecology. You import into the Americas and into Australia ecological systems which result in the virtual extermination
of huge sections of the indigenous population through disease. The only places in the Russian Empire where that happened are Kamchatka and the furthest far north. Apart from that, you don't get this sudden shock of the invasion of one ecological system by others. Nevertheless, I think you shouldn't go overboard, as some Russians certainly do, in stressing just the differences between the Russian imperial tradition and those of the Western maritime powers. Most fundamentally, much of the history of the world since the 16th century has been the history of the expansion of sedentary and Christian societies at the expense of Muslim or animist and often nomadic ones. Russia was obviously a part of that process. Its methods of expansion were based on European technology and European organization. You could argue that the last gasp of Europe's expansion at the expense of Asia is Khrushchev's Virgin Land Scheme in the 1950s, when the Kazakhs are turned into a minority in their own land by massive Slav immigration. And if you could see Russia as playing its part in the expansion of Europe, so indeed you could see it as part of a broader process of contraction as well. In 1800, something like 20% of the world's population were Europeans. By 2050, it'll probably be 5%. A similar demographic pattern is evident in the former Soviet Union. Until the 1950s, the European and above all Slav population grew rapidly at the expense of the rest. Since the 1950s, that process has been dramatically reversed. The non-Slav Muslim populations press on Russia's southern borders in Siberia, as do the peoples of the Maghreb on Italy and Spain and France, and as does the Rio Grande border on the United States. These kind of comparisons between Russia and other maritime European empires have, as I've said, always had a considerable political animus to them. You get less of that political animus when you begin comparing the Russian Empire, as I have been trying to do to some extent, with the other great land empires of particularly Eurasia. I haven't got time at the moment to go into the comparison with China. The one point I would make is that though looked at from a Western perspective, the Chinese and Russian traditions may look very similar in that both empires are what you might describe as both autocratic and collectivist in their traditions by Western standards. Chinese and Russian autocracy, and indeed Chinese and Russian collectivism, are rather different animals. If you take just the example of collectivism, the Russian tradition of collectivism is infused with a very Christian sense of sin, very unlike the Confucian, didactic, optimistic collectivism of East Asia. But in some senses, of these land empires, the most interesting comparison with the Soviet Union is the Ottoman Empire, and that for reasons I will try and explain briefly. The Ottoman Empire genuinely possessed a supranational ideology and a supranational ruling elite. That ideology was religious, dogmatic, even messianic. It was devoted, or at least in principle, its ambitions were worldwide, and they were rooted in the desire to convert. Particularly when you're talking about the first decade of Soviet rule, the comparisons there with Soviet ideology and to the creation of a Soviet elite which is genuinely multi-ethnic and genuinely very far divorced from any kind of pride in Russian cultural or historical traditions is rather close. Now, in the second half, indeed, the whole of the 19th century, but particularly the second half, the Ottoman Empire was commonly regarded as the sick man of Europe. A whole range of other imperial predators ganged up, or queued up, convinced that sooner or later they were going to gobble the Ottoman inheritance. And yet, in a curious sort of way, in retrospect, the Ottoman Empire, from one angle, looks more viable than most of the empires which queued up to eat it. And that for this simple reason, particularly in the contemporary era, the era of nationalism and mass public political consciousness, it is really impossible to legitimize or sustain an empire on the basis of metropolitan nationalism. And that is, in the end, what the sustaining legitimacy of the French, British, German, Dutch, you name it, empires was. precisely because it did have a supranational identity, because quite unlike the distinctly racialist European empires, the Ottoman ruling elite was open to anyone who was a Muslim and was formed from the most diverse backgrounds. In a sense, it had a viability about it which other empires lacked. Even in 1914, dynastic and religious loyalties were far stronger among the Ottoman Empire's Muslim population than any sense of identity based on ethnic or linguistic considerations, modern Western secular considerations. What destroyed the Ottoman Empire in its Muslim provinces was not some kind of irreversible process of revolt from below, but defeat in war, a geopolitical factor. That in itself tells you something about the dilemma of empires as you come into the 20th century, a dilemma which faced not just the Ottomans, the Austrians, Habsburgs, the Russians, and a great many others as well. The point is that as you come into the 20th century, every empire is faced with the nationalist challenge. Now, the most effective and probably, well, certainly the most civilized, probably the most effective response to the growth of nationalist movements is the maximum possible devolution of power from the state to the various communities which form the population, decentralization, consociationalism. Actually, if you look at the Ottoman tradition, the tradition of the millet, which grants a very considerable degree of cultural and educational autonomy to the non-Muslim minorities, you could argue that the Ottoman Empire was strong in this respect as well. It's certainly very interesting that when the Austrian Marxists try to come to terms with the nationalist threat, what they come up with is, in a sense, a modernized version of the millet, the so-called Brunn program of the Austrian Social Democrats, with the creation of national universities, communal autonomy not linked to territoriality. This is a modernized version of the millet. And it's at just this time as well that Oskar Jassy, the most civilized of Hungarian radicals, talks of the Austro-Hungarian monarchy turning into a sort of East European Switzerland. The problem is that if decentralization, consociationalism, modernized millets are the answer to one of the great problems of empire, they seem to be precisely not the answer to the other problem, the geopolitical one. Because at exactly the same time that you're facing the nationalist threat domestically, you're facing on the foreign, on the international sphere, the fact that in the era of imperialism, the only way which seems possible to sustain your independence, to survive, is precisely to create an extremely formidable and centralized military and fiscal apparatus, and to mobilize nationalist feeling behind the polity. After all, in 1900, over the last three or four, in the 19th century, the world had seen a number of once great empires gobbled. It was the general view that next in line would be the Chinese, the Persians, probably the Ottomans. It also seemed self-evident that those countries which were truly powerful and effective on the international scene were precisely the nation states, the British, the Germans. And therefore, the solution to an empire's domestic problem and to its problem of international military competitiveness seemed to pull in precisely different directions. It's one of the crafty aspects of the Soviet Union that it did actually seem to offer some kind of solution to both problems simultaneously. The Soviet Marxist-Leninist democratic centralist state was an absolutely formidable mechanism for mobilizing resources for geopolitical and military ends. Its triumph in the Second World War not merely legitimized the Soviet regime, it also secured Soviet territorial integrity from any possibility of external military threat, and it persuaded a whole range of would-be dissident domestic enemies that the regime was invincible and invulnerable. And yet at the same time as that empire did manage the international geopolitical challenge of empire, it went at the same time some way to satisfying the demands of its domestic non-Russian constituents for at least some degree of cultural and educational autonomy. The Soviet federal system was a fraud, but it was never a complete fraud, and it did allow some degree of cultural autonomy to non-Russians in certain cases, and certainly it allowed non-Russians to occupy a great many posts which carried with them powers of patronage, status, etc., in their own communities. And in other ways as well, the Soviet Union embodied a whole range of principles which were mouth-watering for many, good old 19th century imperialists, not to mention protection of national labour carried to the power of N, extreme autarky, a whole range of great fundamental principles of empire. The basic problem, of course, is that the Soviet Union solves the problems of empire at precisely the moment when empires become redundant, which is what has happened since the Second World War. Before 1914, it was taken as axiomatic that empire, meaning the direct control of populations, territories, commodities, markets, was essential to a country's power. Both Hitler and Stalin's Reich were based on that principle. French politicians after 1945 continued to subscribe to that principle. France without an empire would not be a great power. There were some who even argued that France must fight to stop Algerian independence in order to preserve its control over Siberian oil and gas. Even the British, after 1945, initially imagined that control over imperial commodities, populations and markets would be a very significant factor in Britain's power, would raise Britain out of the common herd of other European states. All these predictions were proved wrong. In the post-war era, free access to markets, to commodities, plus the fact that with the rise of nationalist movements, direct control over far-flung territories and their non-metropolitan populations is more trouble than it's worth. All of these have invalidated the premises on which empire was created. Those states which have done best in the post-war era have often been, like the Germans and Japanese, those who have shared both the burdens and the mentalities of empire. How very much more pleasant it was, for instance, for the Germans to have cheap overseas labour which could be defined as Gastarbeiter rather than as citizens. In historical terms, the Soviet Union and its leaders had some reason to think geopolitically. The Soviet Union came into existence because the capitalist powers were at each other's throats in 1914-17. Communism expanded worldwide because the second round of battles between the imperialist powers opened the gate. The hope was, the prediction was, in 1945 from Moscow, that the same was going to happen. It didn't turn out to be true. And by the 1980s, it was quite clear that Russia was paying a quite impossible price for empire. And many younger generation intelligent Russians were aware of that. The problem was that as the empire began to disintegrate by 1991, and this is coming to the end of the lecture, it was possible to envisage truly apocalyptic consequences of the process of decolonization in the Russian context. If, for instance, you made the comparisons with other processes of decolonization, even with the most peaceful and successful of those processes, the British one, you do have to remember that not merely Britain's contemporary problems in Ulster are post-imperial ones, but so in a sense is the Palestinian issue, the issue between the Indians and the Pakistanis, etc., etc. There was good reason to fear that in the Russian case things would be a great deal worse. The Russian Empire, after all, was centuries old. The Tatars were incorporated in the mid-16th century. The populations were hopelessly intermingled. The centralized command economy would make untangling the economic links of empire far more complicated, even than was the case in the territories of the former Habsburg monarchy. Republican boundaries were arbitrary, republican systems of government were often rudimentary and frequently illegitimate. Above all, the post-imperial setup, the post-imperial order in in the former Soviet Union, was constructed against Russia. Russia was the main loser in geopolitical terms. Now, you can have an international order which is stable and unjust as long as those who sustain it are the powerful. The problem in the former Soviet case is that it was by far the most powerful republic, which in one sense had the greatest reason to reject the status quo post-empire. And the last thought I will leave you with is just how astonishing thus far has been the relative peacefulness of the post-imperial era in the former Soviet Union. By the standards of other empires, civil war in Tajikistan and Georgia and the conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia is very small beer indeed. And it is worth just asking why we should have been so lucky thus far. I stress the point, thus far. We're not out of the wood yet. The breakup of Pakistan came 25 years after independence. The Ulster issue exploded 50 years or more after partition. Nevertheless, it is the immediate period of breakup which is most dangerous, and we've survived it pretty well. I'll leave you with four possible reasons why that's the case. The first one is that within the Soviet federal system, you did have legitimate republican authorities, in the French term interlocuteur valable, through whom it was possible to negotiate the process of independence. And it is not just that those republican authorities existed, point one, and that they were legitimate legal institutions under Soviet law, but also point two, that large sections of the Soviet ruling elite, above all Mikhail Gorbachev, were strongly committed to legality, precisely because they had seen the impact of non-legality on Russia this century. Point three is that if that is true of the elites, it was even truer in some senses of the bulk of the Russian population. The bulk of the Russian population had suffered quite enough in the cause of empire and greatness and was not going to do so again, given the possibility. Indeed, perhaps a professor of politics shouldn't say this, but possibly the best single aspect of post-imperial Russia is the complete depoliticization of the population and its total disbelief in most cases that any useful solutions can come through politics. And finally, you have the point that I've made before. There were sections of the Russian elite who believed that a post-imperial Russia, shed of the burdens of empire, which were increasingly obvious by the 1980s, would actually in time reemerge, not just as a freer and more prosperous nation, but also as a more powerful one. And my conclusion is that those sections of the Russian elite were not and are not necessarily wrong. Given the immense problems which exist in contemporary Russia, it would obviously be miraculous if a freer and more powerful Russia did emerge quickly. In my bones, though, I do expect that given time, this is what's going to happen. Now, in this lecture, I've been relatively presumptuous in charging across a whole range of fields in which there are many people in this audience who are much greater experts than myself. Even I am not so foolish as to predict when the Lord God will actually vouchsafe a miracle to Russia. But as I say, in my bones, I have the strong feeling that he might. That's where I'll leave you.
Well, it falls to me on your behalf to thank our new professor for a veritable feast. I think rarely can the phrase tour d'horizon be more accurate or more apposite. You've raised enormous issues and started, I'm sure in all our minds, a large number of hairs and even more questions. And I think it's time for us to repair to the senior common room, to a reception where together we might ask the one and pursue the other. Dominic, thank you very much.
I'd like to say far too much.